So the opening question was, and I'm sure there will be plenty of debate, best television series ever. Anybody? Okay, Lost. Did someone say The Bachelor? Uh-huh. I have heard of it. Someone else did something back there? Breaking Bad. Uh-huh. The Wonder Years? Uh-huh. So my son, I think it was your suggestion, Aaron, because my son just started middle school, and I was like, this would be fantastic, right? He's going to middle school. My son's going to middle school. We'll watch Wonder Years together. No, not interested at all. At all. Anybody else? My So-Called Life, okay. The Wire, uh-huh. Battlestar, Becky. Doogie Howser, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, so apparently of things I've read and people I've talked to, it seems like there is an agreement, at least with the last decade. A lot of people think the best television shows, top four, usually this isn't that debatable. The Wire, Sopranos, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad. Okay, so usually I've read essays about this, that it's generally agreed upon, and you can have a cordial conversation that these may be the four greatest television shows of the last decade. But if you are to suggest any one of them is greater than the other, then chaos ensues. So this past summer, I took a sabbatical, and it was an opportunity for us. We had some time to catch up on our television watching, which is very important. So we're not caught up on The West Wing. So we were on season one. We're a little behind, so we started watching it again. They're still using, do you remember the Motorola StarTAC flip phone? They're like, the phone would ring, and he'd be like, hello? I was like, how old is this show? My goodness, right? And then all these people started like texting me and emailing me, hey, you're on sabbatical. You got to break bad. It's time to break bad. And so I was like, well, should I watch it? Should I not? And then I made the mistake of watching the first 40 seconds of the show. Check it out. You're welcome. And so you can tell your friends, so how did you start watching that show where the chemistry teacher makes math? You say, my pastor told me. But that's what a strong start to a show, a movie, a book can do that. And I thought this morning it would be a great conversation for us as we are entering into January, even though it kind of feels like October, and that's awesome. But as we're starting off this year, to consider that. And maybe for a lot of us, you know, we've been in this place in our faith where, honestly, it's stagnated for a long time. Maybe we're still showing up. Maybe we haven't been. But when we talk about our faith and there's life, it's always kind of in hindsight or in the past tense. And for us, what would that look like for us to start this year off well? You know, maybe there's others of us and we have these gifts and these talents, or we have these things that we're really passionate about, and we see things in the world that could be done, and we want to do something, but we just can't really get ourselves started. Or maybe there's others of us where we've been on the fence, and maybe we're exploring faith and God, and we're not sure where we stand, and we feel kind of this longing and this draw to it, but we don't really know how or where to start. And this morning in the lectionary, we look at the beginning narrative where Jesus starts off his ministry. And so last week, we left off where he's maybe a toddler, maybe guys from Asia, maybe fortune-telling, stargazing, maybe polytheistic dudes come walking with gifts for a priest, a king, maybe like loads of horses and donkeys are carrying this, and they bring this to this toddler, a gift for a king, a gift for a priest, burial spices. And then for the next 30 years, like nothing really happens. He lives as a refugee in Egypt for a little bit and then makes furniture. That was the most of what happens. Like, here's a coffee table and a banister, 30 years. And then Mark picks up the story where Jesus starts off his ministry. and it starts in the Jordan River. And so before you read it, I'll just give you some context. I found an old postcard of the Jordan River. It's a desertous climate. Similar, if you look at some of the pictures, like I feel like I could float that, right? It's kind of dry. It kind of looks like Texas a little bit. There's parts of it that are more tumultuous. People actually now go rafting at the Jordan River. And you've got Jesus' cousin. He's been hanging out there, and that's where we pick up the scene. So if you have your Bibles, we're going to be in Mark chapter 1. Grab a friend or a neighbor, read verses 9 through 13, and then we'll jump in. Mark 1, 9 through 13. Go. All right. And so this morning, just this idea of starting off, and as we see how Jesus starts off, to maybe consider how we start off the year. And so we pick up in verse 9, and Mark writes, "At the time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan." And so Jesus and John are cousins, right? As far as we know it, they've met one time before in the belly of their mom, right? So the mom's hug, and in the belly, John's like, "That's the one, that's awesome, right there," right? So this is their second meeting. But between belly and the Jordan, Jesus has lived as a refugee, been a carpenter, and then John has kind of carved this other path as, like, probably the leading anarchist activist of his day. He probably would have been vegan if it were not for fashion. Like, he had a pretty sweet, like, camel vest and a leather belt. And he started this movement that maybe he called the Occupy Jordan movement. And he would just post signs. And basically his deal was, you know, this world isn't as it should be, both individually and systemically. Like, how you're living your lives with the chaos and the violence and the fighting, that's not what this world was intended to be, with the systemic injustice and governments and how it's run. Repent from that. Turn from it. And so people would come, they would hear him, and then if they would agree, they would get baptized. And so this was a part of their culture, in ancient Jewish culture. That was a prevalent part. They would get baptized for a lot of ritualistic ceremonies. After birth, there would be this cleansing. Before marriage, there would be cleansing. Before a lot of religious ceremonies, there would be this baptism and a cleansing. But the difference was, John the Baptist was the first one that brought other people in to cleanse them. Before that, they would just go into the water and clean themselves. And so you imagine now, John's got this Occupy Jordan thing going. There's these crowds coming in. And then out of the corner of his eye, he sees his cousin. And he's like, okay, looks a little different than in the womb. Not sure I recognized him. And as he's maybe walking down the line, getting closer and closer, he's thinking, is he going to baptize me? Right? Like, am I baptizing him? Is he baptizing me? And then in the other narratives, it says there's kind of this polite debate, perhaps, right? I should baptize. No, you should baptize. No, you should baptize. No, you baptize me. No, and then finally, Jesus convinces him to baptize, John to baptize Jesus. And commentators say this. What's going on here? There's a few things. Some commentators say probably the main point of this is maybe John was standing in the tumultuous part of the Jordan where the river was rapid and moving. And there was a sign of people coming in with their sin and with their darkness and their struggle and then the chaos of that. And now Jesus, beginning his ministry, was submitting himself to that mission and entering into our chaos and our darkness. Then other commentators say this, that the first act of Jesus was a public display of submission to his father, and then not only to his father, to his anarchist activist cousin, that somehow publicly he would submit himself to that. And I thought that'd be a great question for us as we begin this year. Because I think a lot of times as Americans, as we think, let's have a strong start, let's start something, I'm not sure our first thought is, I should submit. What would it look like to live a life of submission? Any dog owners here? Some of you? Okay. So if you've had dogs or own dogs, Jeremy, raise your hand. I saw Jessica, like, nudging him. You know that training a dog, submission is pretty important, right? So 3 years ago in January, we came home with this thing. And it was at a picnic table, and we were just like, okay, we're coming home with it. And so she was really young. She was waking up in the middle of the night, which I was like, I've woken up in the middle of the night to feed my own kids, but I don't know if this is worth it for this dog. So she did pretty well. We trained her. There were three things that we couldn't really get a hold of, right? So we paper trained her, which worked pretty well. We could not unpaper train her. So she would go on the paper in the bathroom. We would take her out to the park all day, and she would hold it until we got home, and then she would wait for the paper. She'd say, right? I was like, no, it's wrong. And then she would nip at us a lot, and we couldn't get her to stop doing that, and she was just really hyper. And then we got a second dog who was calm, toilet trained, not on paper, and was not nipping at us. The moment we got this dog, everything went away. Because they would play, and then they would wrestle with their tails wagging, and then Trixie, the older one, would grab Mochi by her neck, like do a suplex, like flip her, and then pin her to the ground, right? So for the first 2 days, that's all she did. She just pinned her to submission, and then everything went away. It was perfect, right? And so I thought, as a parent, that'd be perfect. So I'd wrestle with my boys, and then grab them by the neck, and I'd pin them. I'm just kidding. But I want to propose to us this morning that it's not whether or not we submit to things or people. I want to propose that it's just who or what we are in submission to. What are the things in our lives that have us by the neck? I would propose for a lot of us, including myself, it's busyness. Like, we live in this culture in Western industrial society, and no one goes, hey, I want to be more busy. I need to be doing more things. I need to be stretched more thin. But yet, in the season of Advent, in these seasons with our family and friends, we're just so busy, and we can't get out of it. And it's like it's got us by the neck. I would propose that we live in a culture where we're in submission to electronics and the screen. Like, I don't know if you've been in a waiting room or on a bus or on a train. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, everyone's staring at a screen, and we're in submission to that. Maybe for some of us, it's security, that I need to get to retirement, and everything needs to be taken care of. I need to get all my ducks lined up, and we're in submission to that. We live our lives based on that. Some of us, it's what people think of us. Some of us, it's family. Some of us, it's relationships. Some of us, it's not having families in a relationship. And commentators say in Jesus' first act, he gets the order of creation down for everyone. That if you live your life in submission to the Father, then there's freedom. And everything else then is released. And for us, as we begin this new year in a culture that doesn't talk about submission, are we in submission to what God wants in our life? If he were to ask us to do something that didn't make sense and we didn't agree with, would we do it? When we serve the city, when we serve the poor, when sign-up sheets are passed around, like what's the motivation? Why do we sign up for things? Is it because we like the community, we believe in the vision, or is there the sense that, you know, I'm submitting to what God wants in my life? I have gifts, I have talents. You know, Jesus would say things like this. He said, truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees the Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. I think that'd be a beautiful picture and a vision for our community. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. And yes, he will show him even greater works than these so that you will be amazed. And as we enter into 2012, for us to consider in our lives, in our family, in our job, in our planning, what might submission look like? And then he keeps going. And then I picture Jesus coming out of the water. And I don't know if you've seen some of like the new HD, like how many frames per second? Like 30 frames per second. Everything's like super crisp. And I just picture like the Son of God coming out of the water and like beads of drops coming down, right? And then Mark recounts that the heavens open And then the Spirit comes down either as a form of a dove or like a dove, and then it descends on him. And then basically the voice says this, like that right there, that's my son. I love my son. I am proud of my son. My favor rests on my son. And what I find interesting is Jesus hasn't done anything at this point, right? He's just gotten baptized. He hasn't accomplished anything. He hasn't fulfilled his mission. He hasn't been productive. And God says, I love him, and my favor rests on him. And Henry Nouwen says that one receiving of that one line, he says, is the determination of what brings peace in this world and chaos. What brings peace in this life and not peace. When you see a world that's war-torn and violence, it's that point of not hearing, because we act and we work for everything else. And before Jesus does anything, the heavens open and he says, I love, he's loved. You know, a couple days after Christmas, so we stuck around this year. Usually, so my family lives in Toronto, my wife's family lives in Savannah. Usually someone travels, so either they'll come or we'll go. And this is the first year no one moved. So for us, we kind of got to hang out with his family, and then it was nice and quiet, and we enjoyed it. On the 26th, we went down to New Braunfels, and we stayed in a cabin. And it was beautiful. It was right on the Guadalupe. That was our view. And then we stayed kind of on the edge of that cliff. So at the water, you actually climb up quite a bit. And that was our view from the cabin. So it was beautiful, relaxed, did nothing, kind of ate, played games, read, enjoyed the fire. So the first night we hung out, kind of had a late night, had a little fun. So the next day we were kind of sluggish, woke up, it was a slow start. And then we were just sitting around, you know, doing not much. And we noticed that the fire pit at the top of the cliff had no more firewood. We had burned it all. So all the adults were like, well, we could go get some. And then we all just kind of looked down the cliff because it was at the bottom. So we had a choice. Either we go get firewood right now, or we could go back to sleep and read. So all of the adults opted for reading and going back to sleep. So we just took a nap and like lounged around. 2 hours later, we come back to the fire pit, and there's firewood all around the fire pit. And I was like, this is excellent. Who did this, right? So it turned out that Joshua, Noah, and Eli overheard us and then devised this plan to hike all the way down. It's a pretty steep cliff. Hike all the way down. They had to rummage the forest for firewood. Now, they couldn't hike back up the cliff because it was too steep. So they had to throw the firewood over the fence. So they got a pile over the fence. They now had to move this pile to the bottom of the stairs about 100 feet down. They moved to the bottom of the stairs. They now moved the pile to the top of the stairs, from the top of the stairs to this gradual slope back up to the cabins. It took them an hour. So I'm sitting there around the fire pit, and I was like, this is amazing. Everyone needs little boys, right? Little boys are awesome, right? And I'm like, oh, that's why people before in pre-industrial society, everybody wanted kids. This is why. So at that moment, there's no parent that thinks this, right? There's no parent that goes, you know what? When you were a baby, honestly, you were kind of a leech. Like on society, on our family, like you would just take and take. If you didn't get it, you'd just cry, right? And so I didn't really love you, right? You're very needy and selfish. And so up until this point, I was really struggling my love for you. But now that you're useful, I totally love you, right? No parent does that. Every parent, when they're crying, there's love. When they're rebelling, there's love. When they're laughing, there's love. In every moment, when they're helpful, there's love. When they're not helpful, there's love. And Henry Nouwen says the first act of Jesus is the most profound act that this world needs to hear. Because everyone lives on earth, and they're trying to figure out who they are and why they live on this earth. And Henry Nouwen says we usually have three answers. One of our answers is, who am I? I am what I do. Like, I'm valued because I do stuff. I'm creative. I can get a job. I can make money. I serve the poor. I care about justice. I have value because of what I do. And he says, that's wrong. That's a lie. He says, a lot of us, we have value. We value ourselves because of what others think of us. When people say nice things about us, we're really happy. When they don't, we're really sad. you know, for people who speak, or a lot of my friends who are pastors, it's unbelievable how many compliments you could get on speaking. And usually people are nice and kind. They'll be, oh, hey, good job, right? And then out of 40, there might be one person who goes, that was terrible. I didn't agree with anything. And guess what's the one thing you think about? And Henry Nouwen says we define ourselves by what we do, what people think of us, by what we have, our nationality, our race, our education, our family, our parents, our health. And when those things are in place, we're happy. And when we're not, then we're devastated. And Henry Nouwen says you can play out the history of the world by people's struggle of those three things and those three lies. And he says when we come to grips that regardless of who we are, what we have, what we do, that we're loved and the heavens open, he says this world would change. Communities would change. Cities would change. And for us, you know, why do we do what we do? Like why... Again, why do we serve? What when things go well, why are we happy? When that's taken from us, why are we devastated? And what does that look like for us to be a community that is in submission? And then I pray that Vox will be passionate not just about this city, for this community, for the vision, that we'll be passionate for our love for God to us, and then in return to him. And then he keeps going. Then he says this. So, okay, at this point, the heavens open, right? If I were to rewrite this, it would probably go like this, right? And then now Jesus was sent by the Spirit, which he's about to do. And in my narrative, it would go like this. And now Jesus was sent by the Spirit to urban places, right? Because in the suburbs and rural places, they don't really get it. So they'd go there, and now he'd change entire cities, and people would follow him, and their lives would be changed. They'd be better neighbors. Poverty would be alleviated. Babies would be cuter, right? Cities would just change. And then you read this, the next narrative goes like this. And now the Spirit sends him out into the wilderness. And then he was in the wilderness for 40 days, being tempted and tested. And then Mark's the only one who makes this commentary. He says he was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. And the historical context for this is really important. So Mark is writing this probably 50 years after the resurrection. So resurrection probably happened in 20s AD. So this is 50 years after. People who had seen Jesus encounter the resurrection were probably in their old age. So at this point, they're thinking, as we pass, the oral histories won't be able to pass down. We should probably write this down. So he pens, he's the first of the four to pen this. He's probably now writing this in 70 AD. Now guess who's in power at 70 AD in Rome? Many guesses? Nero. Nero. So Nero had an interesting relationship with Christians, mainly used for entertainment, right? He'd be like, hey, I'd have these fantastic dinner parties, and I want, like, sustainable fossil fuels, right, that are completely biodegradable. Let's use human beings, namely Christians. So they would have these parties, and then they would wait for lighting, and on these posts would be people's moms and dads and uncles, and then they would set them on fire. He would now, I think I have a picture of it, send people into arenas among the wild beasts. So what commentators say now is as Mark is writing this, he's now talking to a community who is following Jesus. These churches are now growing and exploding. And then they're being burned at the stake. They're being thrown into arenas with wild beasts. And he's saying the first thing that Jesus did was now himself to be tested, and then for those of us being tested among the wild beasts, that Jesus is with us. And for us, maybe as we enter into the season, that will, for all, a lot of us, maybe we're in that season of testing. Maybe it's like David. And there's this vision for our lives, but spears are being thrown at us. Maybe it's like Moses. We've been given this responsibility, but it kind of now just feels like wandering and we're going in circles. You know, maybe it's like Joseph and we're in prison and we're forgotten and no one just talks about us anymore. Or maybe it's like Daniel. Do you guys remember the story of Daniel? So Daniel had risen to the ranks of the colonial empire, right? So he was now the third most powerful person in the country besides the king. So like politicians do, he had adversaries that started a smear campaign. They're like, we got to take this guy down. So they tried digging up dirt on him. They don't find anything. They Google his name. Nothing comes up. So they now have to start a smear campaign, and it goes like this. They go to the king, and they go, King, we have a wonderful new idea for legislation that we can pass. He's like, yes, tell me. It's like, well, this new legislation should be everyone should pray to you because you are God. And anyone who doesn't pray to you as God, we should do something devastating. So what animal would be devastating? Let's take lions. So if anyone doesn't pray to you, we'll throw them to the lions. He's like, I like this. I like this. People pray to me. If they don't, we will feed them to lions, right? So they're okay, let's get this signed. They get the legislation signed. So Daniel gets wind of this, and his first idea was like, oh, that's weird legislation. I should probably pray about this. So he now goes to his window to pray. The paparazzi are lined up, and they're like, boom, gotcha. They bring this to the king, and then they're like, check this out. He's praying. He's not praying to you. And the king's like, oh, but I kind of like Daniel. They're like, well, you already passed the law. We should be consistent. We should use Daniel as an example. Throw him to the lions, right? So they throw him to the lions. The king really doesn't want to. And then it says that night he's up all night, like he can't sleep. And then he wakes up the next morning, he runs down, and I picture Daniel's like Siegfried and Roy, like lying with the lions. It's like he's wearing a mane. It's like, hello, king, right? But imagine in that moment, for a decision he's made that's right. And we know the flip side, so we're like, oh, he was saved, he wasn't eaten. But as he's about to be thrown in, and in those moments of testing, and as we're in them, I would propose that those moments are testing in the wilderness, in those dark places, how we respond to them are as important, if not more important, than those moments we experience God's call for our lives. As we're trying to figure it out and we don't have answers, how do we respond? If you rewind a little bit in the story of Daniel, he had some buddies named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? And it was the same king, and he was like, hey, I got another great idea. I'm going to erect a statue of gold. It's going to be 90 feet high. So a basketball court is 90 feet in length. So just picture gold 90 feet tall. I'm going to have a band. When the band plays, everyone bows to gold, right? And so the three guys are like, well, no, we don't really bow to gold. We don't really want to do that, right? So word gets back to the king. They're like, what? You will not bow to my gold? And they're like, no, no. So he's furious. He's like, okay, we're going to get a brick oven. We're taking pizza out, and we're throwing people in. He hears the response of these three guys. He turns it up 7 times hotter. He was like, if you don't bow, you're going in the oven. And then their response I love, they're like, well, God will defend us. And so we're not going to bow. But even if God doesn't defend us, even if we're thrown in and we die, nothing is saved, we still won't bow. And in that moment, like picture that, you're walking towards the furnace. And in those moments of testing, how will we respond? They're thrown in. It's so hot that the soldiers that bring them in are burned to death. They go up to like the viewing gallery. They're like, oh, let us check them out being burned. And then they see like dudes walking around. But then the weird thing is it's not one, it's not two, it's not. There's 4 dudes in there. And it says the 4th looks like the Son of God. And in this story, commentators say that in the furnace, in the place of testing, that's where Jesus is with us. And in Mark, his first act out of the water, out of being loved, is to be tested himself and then to be tested with us. And so as we enter into this new year, and as we consider how we're going to start. And this scene always reminds me of, have you seen the Darjeeling Limited? So it's one of my favorite movies. It's Owen Wilson, Adrian Brody, Jason Schwartzman. They're three brothers trying to wrestle with the death of their father, trying to reunite with each other, and then going on a spiritual journey. So halfway through this film, everything has gone awry, right? They're not connecting. Owen Wilson has these laminated cue card schedules that nobody's following. There's this one moment with feathers that was supposed to be beautiful, and everyone ruined it. So they come to this point where they're going to give up, and they've packed their bags, and they're walking off. And as they're walking by this bank of rushing water, do you remember that scene? And as they're walking by, these three brothers see three brothers in the water, and their boat turns over, and they're drowning. And as these three brothers drop their luggage, and they jump in to rescue. And I love that picture. And when I read in how Jesus begins his ministry, that in the waters where we enter, and some of us have, some of us may be considering, but we enter into the waters to be cleansed and rescued. And Jesus, who comes in a rescue mission, he enters into the water to be with us and to rescue. Let's pray together.